of the political cases did you lose? There were the two cases of black clients.
Unless I go through my files and I dispose of an awful lot of them, but unless I dispose of my files, it was safe to say that we handled, at the time that we took account of things at all, we didn't take account, a minimum of 1,000 cases. And of 1,000 cases, now I'm talking about civil rights cases, you know. Of 1,000 cases, it's hard for me to think of one that we lost. I'm talking about the civil rights cases. The other cases are different. Some we won, some we lost. Most of them we won.
And the criminal syndicalism cases?
No, those are civil rights cases.
You classify those as the civil rights
cases? Yeah, those are civil rights cases. I mean things that's monetary value,
yeah,
or a crime like killing someone. That's what I call a crime, not these... anything that involved speech, you know, talk or reading material or so, like that, you know, like that Foley Square trial where they charged them all with everything under the sun, and they dragged in any communist writer who ever wrote anything that had sense or didn't have sense, that was violent or wasn't violent. They brought it all in and attributed it to those people. So, we had a very, very great percentage of winning cases. No question about
now,
that.
Did you handle cases only in the Cleveland or Ohio area, or would you go elsewhere in the country when there was a case versus that the ILD might want?
I practiced in 20 counties. I practiced in 19 counties plus Cuyahoga County. The 19 counties. I went wherever, and then I went outside of Ohio in Virginia, with coal miners. That was a very important case, and I won that. I would attribute, and others have attributed, my percentage of winning to hard work. I didn't take anything for granted. Like with this woman that murdered her husband. Mm-hmm. I used to go around, my husband used to take, he's a great help to me, nights at night to people who knew her or the neighbors to inquire about her, all hours of the night. And then with the miners, the Ohio miners strike, during John L. Lewis's time, you know, I went on many of those cases. And in one case, 18 miners were charged with arson. And they were charged with burning some steeples there, mining steeples, you know, where the mine, the coal, there's steeples in that area around there. Is this thing going?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Well, every time I think of these, I'm tempted to talk about it,
well,
and I shouldn't.
You know, I thought what we might do, let me just ask you why you decided to retire when you did.
Well, that's another book.
Oh.
That's another book. In 1938, after I finished a campaign running for a municipal judge, and the newspapers used to like to quote what do you call these people who run for, who campaign for offices?
The candidates?
Huh?
Candidates? You're not looking for the word candidate.
The candidates, yes. That's not the candidate, but let's say the candidate. They'd call the court of the day, so they quoted me as the joke of the day. And what was it? When I was debating with my others who were running opponents, you know, when I finished talking, whatever I said, I don't know now, but I know this, I said, you know, everything is possible, and it's quite possible that I may not win. Well, they thought that was the joke of the day, because who didn't know that, you know, so that is that. But that is it now. What else was it you wanted me to tell you?
I was wondering why you chose to retire when you did.
Oh, chose to retire. Oh, yes. So in 38, after that election was over, I entered the hospital that I was supposed to have entered a long time with that injury that I sustained that I told you about, mm-hmm. that doorknob from the Diavelli building. For surgery in the Cleveland Clinic. And I went for a long time for treatment there. And on one occasion, there was a terrible fire in that Cleveland Clinic. It was known throughout the nation, I'm sure. Important doctors were killed, some outstanding doctors, and it turned out that they had so many films that it took from people, bone films, and the material ignited after years of being stored away, and the building exploded. It caused an explosion. And that morning I was in the courtroom on an uncontested divorce case, and it didn't take long. And I was footing it with my briefcase, swinging my briefcase, glad it was over, getting back, because I had my office near the courthouse, walking toward the courthouse, and people shouting, "Oh, Mrs. Lang, you're here, you're here. Oh, hurry up, run to your office, run to your office." Because everybody thinks you were, that I went for, as a matter of fact, that's why I was hurrying to keep my appointment for that treatment in the Cleveland Clinic. And my family and all the people who knew me thought I was there. At any rate, after 1938, I entered the hospital in the Cleveland. I forget what hospital it was. No, I think it was the Mount Sinai Hospital, mm-hmm. was the first one. I entered the Mount Sinai Hospital. In later years, the clinic was rebuilt, and I went there. I entered the hospital, and the newspapers carried my hospitalization as follows. So-and-so, which goes to prove that a woman has no right in politics, has no business. A woman has no business in politics. Here I had this dated years back when I had this injury, you know. But I delayed it until after this campaign. Well, that was in 1938. I had my first surgery. And my fifth spinal operation. Mm. Five times, as I remember, Dr. Gardner was from the Cleveland Clinic. He assisted the doctor from the Mount Sinai Hospital. This time, they took me there. He says, "Mrs. Land, I scrub for you five times." Scrub means they open the back, you know. And the back just wouldn't close. It wouldn't heal, you know. It wouldn't heal. It kept open and open and open. And I started practicing law with my back open. But my sister used to bandage it for me. But one night I came for a meeting. I managed to take in meetings also. It was during that time when, I don't know, it was during the war, after the war, I don't know what you I came home late and she was asleep and I had no intention of awakening her. So I took a little footstool and I put it in front of the mirror in the bathroom. Then I took the swabs and the cotton, what you have to use to swab to redo, because I couldn't go to bed with it as it was. I started swabbing my back, and then I felt something warm trickle down my back. And when I realized it was blood, I got sick to my stomach. But I also realized as I moved the swab out, it seemed to me I felt a solid something, you know. And I looked at it, and I saw what looked like a corner of a tooth. The corner of a human tooth, which is about that size, and it didn't take on any of the blood or anything. I could see it through whatever smears it has. And by that time, I was shaking with cold. And I woke my sister, and she put heating pads and on and on everything, and of course called the doctor, and the doctor came, and he saw what was, and he said that was the culprit. See, there's a foreign body. While they were operating on me, and that was the first operation, while they were operating on me, this bone ricocheted, you know, and it went up into the muscles. And all the x-rays they took, and they were treating me, they didn't tell me, but later I learned they thought it was cancerous. Mm. That's why it wasn't closed. And they, who were tops, they called in consultation from other cities, and they shrugged their shoulder. They all looked at it and shrugged their shoulder. Anyhow, I think it was 24 hours when that gaping wound opened, closed like a clam. It closed like a clam, and in the exterior it was fine. But during the period when it was so bad, I went to court with my crutches on. And one of the judges, that was always pretty nasty to me. So I just stood, and I didn't mind standing. I felt better standing than sitting, and he kept taking cases and taking and taking. Finally, I don't know why, I think that they were assigned to certain, that the lawyer had to be present before they assigned you to certain court, you know. Finally, he said, will you step aside a minute? Mrs. Landis was standing there a long time. Oh, I was so surprised, you know. Anyhow, he gave me an assignment for another case, and that was that. But my pain never left me.
Hmm.
What did happen was the nerve that used to impinge on the collapsed vertebrae that collapsed when I hit it with a doornail. So when I sit down, the nerve would impinge and I couldn't get up, because when I'd get up, it would do that, you know. And it was very bad for me, because you cannot do anything in the courtroom when you're addressing the court by sitting down. When you want to make an objection, you can bark objection, doesn't take long, but you can't do it sitting down. And I didn't want to give the judge the satisfaction to know at what expense I do it when I get up, to ask for favors of them, because then they'll have to do it to other judges. So somehow I managed it, but I didn't get up very gracefully, I can tell you that. It was very painful. Well, the first operation removed that nerve impingement, but the collapsed vertebrae was still pressing on the one below it. It gave me the pain, and nothing could help it. So, 2, 3, 4. The fifth operation was the worst. The fifth one, I was already in Phoenix. And I don't remember, I think I had already retired.
Mm.
Because with that condition, it was pretty bad for me to practice law, and the family was opposed to it. Didn't think it was right to do it. There was a doctor in Phoenix that was tops, and all good doctors went to Phoenix, because all retired people, especially those who had problems, went to Phoenix. So this Dr. Williams operated on me, but he said, Mrs. Land, I am not attributing your present problem to the orthopedist that worked on you. It's one of those things. But there's one thing I can tell you. They all use your own bone for grafting. I will not use the body bone, meaning my own body. It is never as successful as bone from a bank, mm-hmm. a bone bank.
Mm-hmm.
See, I'm telling you everything reversed. It's just reversed the other way around. It is the bone from a bank that is not successful, he says. And the previous orthopedist used bank bone. And I will not. He says, body bone, I am sure it will be good, the body bone. And may I deviate to tell you something about my What do you call this when you reverse the thing?
With the antibodies, you mean?
Huh?
With the antibodies of the system, you mean?
No. It's something else. About saying the reverse of what you want to say.
Oh.
No, I better close this now. Close with that one, yeah. At any rate, I said, well, I'll have to confer with my family on that. I conferred with my older son, with Jerry. And he was very much concerned. He said, let me have something in writing from Dr. Williams. I still have his letter. Well, he says, we can operate on your mother. It's a serious operation, but she will be relieved of her pain. And we can only do it with body bone. So I did.
Now, your husband was no longer alive?
Well, my husband was alive, but I wanted Jerry to do it, because I know my husband would say, no, don't do it, you know. And I thought, Jerry, he's younger, and he could take those things, and he's... He did. He operated on me in 48, about 9 years after the first four operations. And he did graft bone from the other side, took bone from the other side. And after I got to be where I could be put into a body cast, and started a walk, I began to feel that I wasn't walking right, that I was leaning to one side. And when I'd go to bed and get out of the cast, I was sure that I was lopsided. See, I was lopsided. And my sister was the first one to notice it. She's a nurse. And my son didn't want to believe it. He says, Celia's so used to seeing these things that I'm afraid she's seeing things. He didn't want to believe that it was either so. But as time went on, they all realized that I was lopsided. But I kept going to visit Dr. Williams, I don't know which. At any rate.
Were you relieved of the pain, though?
Huh?
Were you relieved of the pain that you had, though?
Very much. I was very much, but as a matter of fact, I was getting pain on the side where they took the bone. So when I first told him that, he says, well, it's new. You've got to give it a chance to heal. You've got to give it. There's no scar on the outside. I don't know how they reached it, you know. But the original scar is so big that they were able to open it wide enough to reach what they wanted. And finally, I came to him one day with this. I said, Doctor, I am lopsided, see? And I still, at that time, I still had a sense of humor and put in a crack, lawyers are supposed to be crooked, you know. I said, now I'll tell you this, Doctor, it is not because I'm a lawyer. I am not crooked because I'm a lawyer. I am crooked because of the operation, because I was not crooked before. And if in doubt, I'll show you some of the photographs, full photographs, standing up with or without my family. You know. So he opened my file, and he did a lot of drawing and a lot of talking. And I'm not exaggerating. He said a lot of drawing and a lot, and talking mostly language I didn't understand, mostly medical term, that, and that. And then all of a sudden, he took his pencil and just put it down like that, and he walked out. And I don't remember whether he said just a minute or wait a minute or not. I don't remember. I know he walked out, and I sat for the longest time. And after a long time, a nurse came in, or a secretary. She said, Mrs. Land, the doctor says, that'll be all for today. You see? And I gather he realized what he did, and he couldn't talk it away. And what is happening, that I have been tilting the last doctor that took care of me for this back. I don't know whether it was in Berkeley or in Phoenix. I don't remember where. Anyhow, he said, this is land you've tilted 3 inches.
Hmm.
And he says, when a spine tilts 3 inches, everything else tilts in you, and you soon have malfunctions of different organs of your body, and you begin to have A, B, C, D, and so on, all the things. And that is just the story of my back. And the pain as I sit and talk to you now is exactly as it was before I was operated, except there isn't that nerve impingement. It's just like a bad baseball in there. No, like bad teeth, like when you have bad teeth in your mouth. But that isn't all I've had. I've had surgery left and right, all kinds on my knee. When I went to my second operation, when I was notified that there's a bed waiting for me, I was so anxious to have it over with. I rushed into the shower to shower. And as I came out, and my sister came up with, I don't know, to help me with towels or something, I started to neigh like a horse and pretend, kicking with my feet. She, no, that's the door. And I slipped and landed in the hospital, not only with a bad back, with a bum knee. And on and on and on and on and on.
But so, you did come out of retirement then for the Smith cases.
Huh?
But you did come out of retirement then for the Smith Act cases.
Yes, I came out of it. I came out of retirement and handled the Smith Act case since then. And I handled the Ohio, the first case. Seal, come on in. Meet a hard-working lady. I'll just finish this last thing and then... Is it on? My sister came in either with a towel or something to help me. And I thought I held on to something on the side of the wall. But I slipped. What did we have in that bathroom on Yale Avenue? You remember what flooring you had? Anyhow, the slippers may have been tied. Huh? Marble, something. Anyhow, I slipped on that and injured my knee. And then I landed in the hospital with a knee operation and another thing on the back. That was, but I think I want to stop with that because the doctor Williams did in Phoenix, I think it was Phoenix,
Williams.
Made me
Phoenix.
Williamson, huh?
Phoenix.
Made me crooked. See, so that's one of the things. So that's one of the reasons for retirement.
Mm.
And there may be others. Anyhow, I have a pretty rich history of no goodness. And I said to my sister,
but of goodness too.
Whenever somebody decides to make any note of who's there, she should put on there, there lies damaged goods, because I was damaged goods. But I did tell you I would say something about that miners, the arrest of that arson
mm-hmm.
case. I think it was Marysville, or some kind of ville. Anyhow, I don't know how the case came to me. I think it was the IOD. I'm not too sure. But at any rate, the defendants were all locked up. So obviously they did not come to me. But somebody came mm-hmm. to Cleveland, a relative or a friend or something, and wanted me to handle the case. And when I came there, the people in charge, I think the people in charge knew very little. All they knew that these miners were arrested, charged with arson for burning a steeple. And they told me stories about the way they're all packed into one cell, that all they can do is stand, standing room only. But I got this important information from one on the committee, that next to them is one of the miners in a cell by himself. See, he's in a cell by himself. And they are pretty sure that that one miner is going to be a state's witness because he was against the strike.
Mm.
See, he was opposed to the strike. So he was without work, and they were without work, and but he was one of those. I thought, well, My best bet is to see if I can make friends with this fellow, see what I can find out. So when I said goodbye to them, I walked slowly and looked in there. I said, "Hi, how are things?" He said, "Oh, fine. How's your family?" I says, "Now, before I say anything else, I want you to understand, I'm not trying to be your lawyer, because I'm the lawyer for the people next door. I just thought since you're locked up and I'm out, I might be able to give your family a message if you..." "No," he said, "I haven't seen them. You might like a message to your family." He said, "You bet your life I would." Well, he told me a story that was unbelievable. But I believe it. It's too good to be true. He said, "The sheriff tells me that if he wins this case, he's going to make me his deputy sheriff. And I'll be getting more money than I get as a minor. But he does not allow me to see my family. When I ask for my family, he says, 'Oh, they're fine. I see them. They're all right. So if you like to go by and see my family and tell them that I'm all right, I'll sure appreciate it.' I said, 'I'll be very glad to do that. You want to give me their address?' He gave me their address, and I went there. And what the woman told me was the following. That he comes by every time the children are home from school and they're eating. And he comes and says that Bill is fine. I don't think his name is Bill, but Bill is fine. And we better be good and behave ourselves, that pretty soon Bill is going to be all right. You know, emphasize. He didn't tell him how it's going to be all right. And next time they come and say, Bill is going to be better off than he ever was, you know. But he would do the following. He'd make passes at her. He'd go behind her chair and reach over, pretending he's taking some food for himself, and the other hand he'd try to stick run it into her bosom. And the poor woman, being frightened to death and being afraid it would go against her husband, she didn't know what to do. She just had to struggle to get away. She explained all this to me, and I didn't lose any time in explaining it to her husband. I said, "Well, what do you think of that sheriff?" Because he said, "He's fine, sheriff treats him fine and all that." He said, "Can I talk to you?" I says, "Oh, yes." I said, "I don't have to be a lawyer, but it's anything you want your wife to know, you can talk to me." And he was still alone in that big cell. And I wasn't deaf, as you know. I wasn't deaf at that time. He talked quietly, and the story is a very long one, but in substance. He would wait till the other prisoners were asleep. And he would come to his cell and quietly unlock his cell and take him out and go into the garage with him. They would get on the sheriff's motorcycle, the two-seater motorcycle. He always had a flask with him of liquor. And what went on was the following. You will take the stand, and you say you saw all of these guys running to that steeple, not the steeple where we're at, but the steeple that went on fire. Run to that steeple, and you saw them setting fire, that they said, they said you might as well burn it up as let it stand idle. That's what they're supposed to have said. Then, as soon as they are locked up, I will make you my deputy sheriff. This motorcycle will be yours, and you'll get yourself another sheriff in the place of where I am or somewhere else. And I don't know whether he named a figure of his salary or not, and you'll never have to go back to be a miner again. I said to him, shall I tell this to your wife? He said, I'll tell you what you do. You tell some of it to my wife and ask her if she wants me to hire you as my lawyer, because she hasn't got any money. See, so now I know that it was an ILD case, you know. Mm. She hasn't got any money to hire a lawyer, and this guy says, I don't need a lawyer. Well, that was the story. I went back and I told her, but if you reveal what I told you, even to one of your children, I will not defend your husband, because once it's out, it's no good. See, it's just no good. Either he'll be afraid to tell it, or they'll do something, it'll be no good. We went to trial, and the deputy was the first witness. And he told the story, how he has an eyewitness to the arson, where they're sitting there talking, and then one got a brainstorm. Nobody's letting people stand idle when you can't work and have no this and that and the other thing. And one got a bright idea to set up fire. I saw them run. I saw them all run, but I was the only one that didn't run, you see, for the fire. Anyhow, so that's what the deputy told the judge. So without a jury, it was just a judge. Mm-hmm. In those little hick towns, there were no judges. One man is everything in the town, you know. He says, call your next witness. And he called whatever the guy's name was. And the prosecutor started to examine him. Your name is so-and-so, yes. And you were on the scene of the fire such and such night and such people, yes, sir. And you saw the fire put there? Well, what were you doing before the fire started? Well, we were all sitting at steeple number 3, and we were just talking. We were just talking. And then what happened? How did you all happen to go there? Oh, I didn't go there. He says, I didn't go to the fire. And the prosecutor asked him a few more questions, and he smoothed it over that he shouldn't have to go in too much of detail. And you are sure that you were there when the fire was started? Yes. And you're sure that all these defendants were there? He says, yes, they were. That's all, Your Honor. That's our case. I put my case on. I said to him, you were there when the fire was started, yes? You were there, yes. And you were all sitting and talking, yes. And you are sure that all these defendants were there? Yes, ma'am, they were all there. I said, will you tell the judge where you were sitting at the time? He says, at the same place that the other people were sitting. And where were the others when the fire started? He sat and he looked at me and looked at me. I says, where were these people when the fire started? Were they running to the steeple or were they sitting? He says, we were all sitting. All of you, all of these defendants are sitting there? And did you see who started the fire? No, just far away from us. Why did you tell the sheriff so-and-so, that somebody had a brainstorm and then you saw them all run to start the fire? Well, I said, Your Honor, will you permit this defendant to tell actually why he gave the testimony he did? Because I couldn't do that, you know, I couldn't lead him. He told the whole story. He told the whole story exactly as he told me, you know, what the sheriff promised to him and so on. And now will you please tell, and he stopped, he says, now will you please tell the court why, now which is the true story? What the sheriff said you told him or what you told the court now? He says, what I told the court now. What made you change your mind? Will you please tell the court? And he told the court the whole story, what the sheriff did, how he'd take him out nights on the motorcycle, liquor him up and promise him the job, if he will tell the story that way, and in the meantime, what he did to your wife, to your family. And the judge rested that way, he looked at the sheriff, and he went like that. Defendants are discharged. He barely uttered his word. Defendants are free. That's how I won that arson case.
It shows what human compassion can do, though, just asking that man who's been isolated if you can help him.
Yes, not only that, but he was on strike. He was without a job, and he didn't want to strike, see? He needed money. And whether he was getting enough or not was beside the point. Mm. He needed money, he had a wife and little children, he didn't want to strike. And when he got a promise of such a thing, an officer and a motorcycle and what have you, what does the jailing others compare to that?